Welcome back to Mama Mystery. I am your host, Kelly. Today, we are talking about a case that's been bothering people for more than 2 decades, and it's back in the news right now. I told you guys a little bit about this on a weekly docket a couple weeks ago, and I told y'all I was going to do a deep dive, and that is what today's episode is. So in 2000, a 21-year-old woman named Sarah Pender was convicted in connection with the murders of her roommates, Andrew Cataldi and Trisha Nordman, in Indianapolis. Prosecutors called her the female Charles Manson, said that she masterminded the whole thing, and she was sentenced to 110 years in prison. A few years later, she made headlines again when she escaped from an Indiana prison with the help of a correctional officer and spent months on the run before she was finally caught. Well, now, more than 25 years later, Sarah is 46 years old, and she stood in front of a judge earlier this month asking for a second chance. She says that she accepts responsibility for her role, but doesn't believe that she should have to die in prison. Even the former prosecutor who once compared her to Charles Manson is now saying that her sentence is a major injustice. So today we're going to walk through who Sarah is, what happened in that house in 2000, the investigation, the escape, and why so many people are suddenly rethinking this case. This is the story of Sarah Pender. Sarah Jo Pender was born in May 1979, which made her about 21 years old at the time of the murders. By most accounts, she was a bright young woman. She grew up in Indiana, did well in school, even earned a scholarship to Purdue University. At Purdue, she started off studying science, physics, with hopes of a career in biochemistry. So we're talking about someone who had her life on a pretty promising track. However, like many college students, Sarah hit some financial bumps, and after completing her freshman year, she ended up dropping out of Purdue, reportedly because she couldn't afford to continue. Back home in Indianapolis, Sarah tried to move forward. She got a job as a secretary at a construction company and even found herself reading blueprints and considering going back to school for drafting. By summer of 2000, her life seemed pretty normal. Work, plans for the future, nothing foreshadowing the crime that was to come. But then, whether it was fate or misfortune, intervened when Sarah met a man named Richard Hull at a Phish concert in July of 2000. You know how it goes. Outdoor music, good vibes, maybe some questionable decisions. And for Sarah, that's where she fell head over heels for Richard Hull. So who is Richard Hull? Well, at first glance, Richard was this hulking former high school football star from Noblesville, Indiana. But beneath the jock exterior, Richard had a troubled streak. By 2000, he was an ex-convict with a criminal record that included felonies like auto theft, and he was heavily involved in the drug scene, using and selling methamphetamine, LSD, you name it. Not exactly an ideal boyfriend resume, not exactly who you would want to bring home to your parents, but when Sarah met Richard, he was charismatic enough to sweep her off her feet, but he also came with some serious baggage. He was dealing drugs and hanging out with some dangerous company. Despite those red flags, though, Sarah and Richard began a whirlwind romance in the summer of 2000. Sarah moved in with Richard pretty quickly to a small 2-bedroom house on Indianapolis's near South Side that she actually paid for and rented in her name, which is going to be a pretty common theme throughout their relationship. So if you're picturing a cozy little love nest, pump the brakes, because Richard soon invited two of his friends to crash with them: Andrew Cataldi and Trisha Nordman. Sarah says she allowed it because these were Richard's friends who had also fallen on hard times, but what she didn't know initially was just how much trouble was following Andrew and Trisha. So let's talk about them. They weren't just a random couple down on their luck. They had serious backstories of their own. Andrew Cataldi was 25 and Trisha Nordman was 26. They were a couple from Nevada who had come to Indiana seemingly looking for a fresh start. In reality, they were fugitives from Nevada. Both had criminal histories. Andrew had been incarcerated out west for dealing meth, and Trisha had served time for a forgery charge. In fact, they reportedly met in prison in Nevada and even escaped together. Trisha was a mother of three, described as a kind person who struggled with drug addiction, and Andrew was her partner in both life and crime. They fled Nevada and somehow ended up in Indiana seeking refuge with Richard Hull, who was an old friend of Andrew's. So by the fall of 2000, you've got this volatile mix under one roof. Sarah, who seems to be the responsible one, working a legitimate day job to pay the rent. And then Richard, Andrew, and Trisha, who were three people allegedly building a meth operation in the basement and engaging in all sorts of illegal activity. So as you might imagine, tension started simmering in that house. According to later accounts, arguments were frequent, especially between Richard Hull and Andrew Cataldi. They butted heads often, possibly over drug deals or money. Trisha and Andrew, as house guests, weren't exactly model tenants either. None of them, besides Sarah, held a real job. And Sarah was growing frustrated that she was the only one paying the bills while illegal drug business was being conducted literally under her roof. Sarah would later say that she laid down some ground rules, that if Andrew and Trisha were going to stay, there would be no selling drugs out of her house. But it appears that rule was ignored, shocker, and Sarah herself wasn't completely uninvolved, as she sometimes partook in the drug use happening around her. But it's clear that she was uncomfortable with how out of control things were getting. By October of 2000, just a few months into this arrangement, Sarah allegedly told Richard she wanted the roommates to be gone. The stage was set for something bad to happen, and unfortunately, it did in a hugely violent way. So let's zoom in on the critical night of October 24th, 2000. Earlier that day, Sarah and Richard made a shopping trip. Richard Hull, being a convicted felon, couldn't legally buy a gun, but he wanted one. He told Sarah he wanted to go out in the country and shoot stuff. A line like that, in hindsight, raises all kinds of red flags, but nevertheless, that morning, Sarah went with Richard to a Walmart and purchased a 12-gauge shotgun and ammunition for him. The store clerk even noted that it was Richard who picked out the ammo, while Sarah was the one who paid for it. Sarah later said that she thought Richard just wanted the gun for recreational shooting, maybe hunting. She didn't suspect that he had anything sinister planned, despite the fact that he has no job, he's doing drugs, and he's selling drugs, and now he wants a gun. But sure, let's believe he just wants to go out into the field and shoot clay. Whether you believe that or not, the fact remains, Sarah Pender bought the murder weapon that day. That evening, things seemed pretty normal at first. Sarah and Richard actually spent part of the night visiting Sarah's parents, a pretty mundane family visit, and returned home to their place on Michael Street around 11 p.m. But as soon as they got back, the powder keg blew. An argument erupted between Richard and Andrew almost immediately. Reportedly, the two men were in the midst of building a meth lab in the basement, just to kind of give you an idea of the environment, and some dispute set them off. The fight escalated intensely. Sarah later recounted that she became irritated with the chaos and decided to leave the house for a while, like just maybe go for a walk to cool off. Now, this is one of those pivotal moments that's been the subject of endless debate. Sarah claims that she walked away and was not present for what happened next. Skeptics have asked, was this convenient timing or part of a plan? And we will explore that, but let's continue with her story first. According to Sarah, when she eventually came back home, she walked into a horrifying scene. She says that she stepped through the door and found Richard Hull standing over two bodies on the floor. Andrew and Trisha were dead, both shot with the shotgun that she had purchased earlier that day. The scene was gruesome. Andrew had been shot in the chest, and Trisha had been shot twice, in the chest and in the head. Blood was everywhere in that tiny house, and in an interview years later, Sarah described her shock and terror at that moment, saying, quote, "When I came in, Richard was standing over a body. It must have been Trisha's. I was terrified. This man I loved had just killed two people. I remember thinking very clearly, oh, I'm about to die," end quote. In her mind, she was next if she didn't handle things very carefully. Now let's pause here, because this is Sarah's version, that Richard acted alone while she was not there and she just stumbled onto the aftermath. There's no direct evidence that Sarah was physically present during the killings, no eyewitnesses placing her in the house at the moment of the trigger being pulled. But what she did after the murders is undisputed and is one reason she got in such deep legal trouble. Faced with this nightmare scenario, Sarah made a series of bad decisions, understandably perhaps if she feared for her life, but bad nonetheless. Richard was standing there with a smoking shotgun and two corpses. He turned to Sarah and basically said, "Help me get rid of them." And Sarah did. She later admitted that, yes, she helped Richard Holt dispose of Andrew and Trisha's bodies and clean up the crime scene. She said that she was in fear and just obeying Richard to stay alive. In her words, she said, quote, "I was never afraid of him before, but at that moment, I felt that angering him could be dangerous," end quote. So she helped wrap the bodies in bed linens, and then together they carried the bodies to Richard's pickup truck. Richard and Sarah drove them to a location about a mile away, the 800 block of South Meriden Street, or I'm sorry, Meridian Street in Indianapolis, where there was a dumpster behind a building. In the dark of that night, they dumped Andrew and Trisha's bodies in the trash bin like garbage. After dumping the bodies, Sarah and Richard tried to clean up their tracks. They went back to the house on Michael Street and scrubbed and cleaned the bloody crime scene as best they could that night. By the next morning, October 25th, Sarah attempted to carry on like nothing happened. In a rather astonishing detail, she went to work at her job the very next day, acting completely normal. Coworkers later said that Sarah was happy and upbeat on October 25th, not appearing distressed or fearful. She didn't confide in anyone or call the police. Maybe she was in shock and denial, or maybe, as prosecutors later argued, this indicated a cold, calculating side to her. I will let you ponder that. But despite their cleanup efforts, this double murder was not going to stay hidden for long. On October 25th, that same day, a dumpster scavenger, or maybe a passerby, discovered the bodies of Andrew Cataldi and Trisha Nordman in that trash bin. The victim's injuries were brutal. Identification was tricky because of the trauma, but they noticed tattoos on the bodies and used those distinctive tattoos, along with help from neighbors who had seen the couple, to eventually confirm it was Andrew and Trisha. The FBI was even involved to run fingerprints which matched records and confirmed both victims were indeed wanted fugitives from Nevada. With identities established, police quickly traced Andrew and Trisha to the address that they'd been staying, Sarah and Richard's house on Michael Street. Investigators went there and they found a pretty gruesome reality. Despite the cleanup, there was still plenty of blood evidence in the home indicating that it was the murder scene. By then, however, neither Sarah nor Richard was at the house. They had fled, possibly anticipating that authorities were going to come for them. Needless to say, it didn't take long for law enforcement to piece together who their prime suspects were. Andrew Cataldi and Trisha Nordman had been living with Richard Holt and Sarah Pender, and now Andrew and Trisha were dead. So naturally, the spotlight turned to Richard and Sarah. A manhunt was launched to find the couple who seemed to have vanished from the house. But it didn't take long, just 2 days. On October 27th, police located and picked up Richard and Sarah. It's not clear where they were found, possibly crashing with acquaintances since they had abandoned their bloody house, but officers brought them in for questioning. And here is where things get interesting. Sarah immediately cooperated with police once she was in custody. She waived her right to remain silent and gave a full statement to detectives. In this initial statement, Sarah came clean about a lot of things, except pulling the trigger. She admitted to helping Richard dispose of the bodies and to cleaning up the scene, but she maintained that she did not participate in the actual killings. She painted herself as a terrified bystander who helped only out of fear that Richard would harm her if she didn't. At that point, Richard Hull was immediately arrested for the double homicide, but something surprising happened with Sarah. Initially, police let Sarah Pender go home after her statement. Imagine that. She had just confessed to helping move two dead bodies and clean up a crime scene, yet she walked out of the police station that day. Why? Well, possibly the detectives believed her version that she hadn't planned or committed the murders, seeing her as a cooperating witness at first, or maybe they just didn't have all the evidence yet. But in any case, Sarah was free for the moment on October 27th, while Richard sat in jail facing murder charges. But that freedom was extremely short-lived. The very next day, October 28th, police uncovered a critical piece of evidence that changed their view of Sarah's role. They confirmed from Walmart records that Sarah was the one who had purchased the murder weapon, that 12-gauge shotgun, on the day of the killings. This was pretty damning because it suggested premeditation or at least active involvement. If she bought the gun for the crime, as prosecutors would later argue, then it tied her directly to the murders. Combined with her admission of helping dispose of the bodies, investigators now felt that they had enough to charge Sarah as well. So on October 28th, Sarah Pender was arrested and charged with 2 counts of murder, just like Richard. Now let's think about this for a second. She's a 21-year-old facing double murder charges, claiming she didn't kill anyone but admittedly did a lot of incriminating cleanup. It's not a good look. But at that time, the case against her was largely circumstantial. There was no eyewitness, no forensic evidence like her fingerprints on the trigger. It was basically the fact that she bought the gun and then helped cover it up versus her insistence that she wasn't involved in the actual shooting. If that was all the evidence, this might have just been a lesser charge like assisting an offender or something. However, prosecutors were convinced that Sarah was more than just a passive helper. They suspected she orchestrated the whole thing, and soon they would obtain 2 pieces of evidence to support that theory. Evidence that would become highly controversial later on, a letter and a jailhouse snitch witness. By the time Sarah's case went to trial, the prosecution had built a dramatic narrative around her. According to the Marion County Deputy Prosecutor Larry Sells, Sarah Pender wasn't just along for the ride, she was actually the evil genius behind it all. Sells portrayed Sarah as extremely intelligent, manipulative, and even seductive, claiming that she essentially pulled the strings while Richard Hull pulled the trigger. This is when he infamously labeled her the female Charles Manson, likening her influence over Hull to how Charles Manson got his followers to do his dirty work. It's a heck of a nickname to pin on a 22-year-old woman in court, and it definitely stuck because the media ran with it and it loomed over Sarah's image at trial and beyond. But nickname aside, what evidence did the state have to prove Sarah was the mastermind? Well, it was mainly 2 things. So one was a confession letter. Prosecutors produced a letter that was allegedly written by Sarah while she was in jail. It was addressed to Richard Hull, in which she appears to confess and take responsibility for the murders. This letter that was dated May 16th, 2001, was a bombshell. In it, the writer, who is purporting to be Sarah, says things like, quote, "I didn't mean to kill them. It must have been the acid. Drew was so mean that night, I just snapped," end quote. The letter also oddly thanks Richard for, quote, "sticking to your promise," end quote, of taking the blame, and ends with the postscript saying, "destroy this." So all very incriminating. The letter surfaced months after the arrest. Richard Hull handed this letter to his attorney, claiming that Sarah had secretly sent it to him in jail, and somehow it wasn't caught by authorities initially. While at trial, a forensic handwriting expert, Lee Ann Harmless, testified that the handwriting matched Sarah's, and this was devastating evidence, a confession in her own words, apparently, allegedly. And Sarah's defense, of course, argued that the letter was a total fake. So we'll come back to this controversy, but at trial, the letter was allowed and the jury got to see it. The second piece of evidence that was used against her was the jailhouse informant, Floyd Pennington. This was a big piece. So Floyd testified he was an inmate who had struck up correspondence and a romantic pen pal relationship with Sarah while they were both locked up awaiting trial at different facilities. So Floyd was a career criminal, a convicted child molester, an armed robber, among other things. Truly grade A character material. She just knows how to pick them. But according to Pennington, he and Sarah wrote 75 letters back and forth and concocted a plan to meet in person. They managed to arrange to both be taken to Wishard Memorial Hospital on the same day under false pretenses, each faking an illness, so that they could see each other. And this did happen. On September 22nd of 2001, Floyd and Sarah both ended up at the hospital at the same time, and they had a face-to-face conversation. Now, Floyd claimed that during this illicit hospital rendezvous, Sarah confessed to him that she had planned the murders and coerced Richard Hull into executing Andrew and Tricia. On the witness stand at Sarah's trial, Floyd told the jury essentially, Sarah admitted she didn't pull the trigger, but she made Rick do it and was calling the shots. And this, of course, aligned perfectly with the prosecution's female Charles Manson theory. They had an actual witness saying, she told me she masterminded it. Now, it's worth noting, Floyd Pennington was offered a deal in his own pending charges after agreeing to testify. He had been facing up to 56 years on a robbery and other charges, and by cooperating, he expected leniency. The defense at trial tried to paint Pennington as unreliable. He was, after all, a jailhouse snitch with a laundry list of felonies. But the jury didn't hear everything about him. Some details only emerged much later, which I'll get into. At the time, though, he presented a very damaging narrative against Sarah. Aside from the letter and Pennington, the rest of the case was circumstantial but suggestive. Sarah bought the gun, that's a fact. She didn't try to stop or report the crime, also a fact. She helped hide it, that's a fact. The prosecution argued that those aren't the actions of an innocent wallflower. Those are the actions of an intentional participant. They also suggested a motive, too. Maybe Sarah was fed up with her freeloading roommates or involved in a drug dispute. One theory floated was that Richard and Andrew were cooking up a big drug deal and Sarah wanted the roommates gone, possibly even telling Richard to do it. The defense countered that this wasn't some calculated plot, but a spontaneous act of violence by Richard alone. Sarah's attorney, James Nave, told the jury that Sarah was no criminal mastermind, that this crime was not a cleverly planned act, it was an act of the moment. He argued Richard Hull shot the roommates in a rage because Andrew was about to cut Richard out of a drug deal, a motive that had nothing to do with Sarah. Sarah herself did not testify in her trial. Many defendants don't because it's kind of a liability, very risky to go undergo cross-examination. We've seen that play out and it doesn't typically end well. So in the end, the jury basically had two very different interpretations. Was Sarah a frightened girl who got in over her head with a dangerous boyfriend? Or was she a cold-blooded puppeteer who used Richard to do her dirty work and then tried to hide her hand? Well, the trial concluded in August of 2002 and the verdict came in. Sarah Jo Pender was found guilty on two counts of murder. The jurors evidently believed the prosecution's version. That letter and Pennington's testimony likely sealed her fate. At her sentencing, the judge did not go easy. In fact, the court threw the book at Sarah. She was sentenced to a total of 110 years in prison. Essentially, that was two consecutive 55-year terms, 45 years for each murder, plus additional time added on, possibly for a firearm enhancement or conspiracy. Indiana sentencing math can kind of be weird. But to Sarah, who was 22 by then, 110 years was effectively a life sentence. I mean, that's a life sentence for anybody. But she later said, quote, I thought the judge would give me 45 years. 110 years was unfathomable, end quote. Now, for context, Richard Hull, the admitted shooter, actually never went to a jury trial. He took a plea deal to avoid the death penalty or life without parole. Richard pleaded guilty to his role in the murders. In exchange, he received a 75-year sentence. Later on, due to some legal technicalities, he was resentenced to 90 years, which I'll explain in a second, but the optics are striking. Sarah got 110 years, while Richard got 75, even though he was the one that pulled the trigger. So, with the bang of a gavel, Sarah Pender went from a college dropout with no criminal record to an infamous convicted murderer, heading to Indiana Women's Prison to serve one century and then some. It might have seemed like the end of the story, case closed, but in reality, things were just getting started. What happened after the trial is a saga of escaped convicts, solitary confinement, recanted testimony, and a growing chorus of doubts about whether Sarah Pender really deserved that female Manson label.
Before we go on, I want to take a moment to thank the sponsor of today's episode. So we all know what our chronological age is. It's just your birthday, right? But biological age is how old your body actually is on the inside. And that part matters way more than most of us realize. Your biological age is one of the strongest predictors of disease risk and overall longevity, basically how your body is aging over time. And that is where True Diagnostic comes in. They used advanced epigenetic testing to analyze over 1 million data points from a simple at-home test to tell you how fast you're aging and what's actually going on inside your body. And the best part is they don't just dump the data on you. They give you a clear, personalized 90-day plan so you know exactly what to do with the information that you get. There are a couple different testing options depending on what you want to focus on. So they have their True Age test, which looks at longevity and aging. It compares your biological age to your chronological age, shows your current pace of aging, and even breaks things down by organ system, like your heart, brain, lungs, immune system, and more. You get your top three aging actions to focus on, and get this, 86% of users who follow the plan actually reduce their biological age. They also have True Health, which focuses on how healthy you are right now. It checks over 105 vitamins, minerals, nutrients, and health markers, with a big focus on energy, metabolism, inflammation, and nutrient status. Again, you get your top three health actions to work on over the next 90 days. Or if you want the full picture, there's the combo kit, which honestly is the best value. It combines both True Age and True Health so you can see how fast you're aging and how healthy you are today. Plus, you get three aging actions and three health actions to focus on for each quarter. The process itself is super simple. You order online, the kit ships right to your door, you do a quick finger prick at home, and then drop it in the prepaid return package. Your results come digitally along with an easy-to-follow 90-day plan, and your only job is to follow the three recommendations for 90 days. Then you can retest and actually see your progress. So you can do a one-time kit if you want just a baseline or if you're curious, or you can do the subscription, which gives you four tests per year. That turns it into an accountability tool instead of a one-and-done type of thing. You're tracking your real changes over time. That's the kind of person that I am. I like to overanalyze and, like, you know, paralysis from analysis. That's very much me. So if you're like that, I can see why you would want to do the subscription as well. Now, this is the same type of testing used by top longevity clinics and health professionals. It is real science. It's not trends or guesswork. And it helps cut through the noise by showing you the three most important things your body actually needs right now. And right now, my listeners can get 20% off at truediagnostic.com using the code Mama at checkout. That's True Diagnostic, TRU diagnostic.com, and use the code MAMA, MAMA, for 20% off today. Choose True Age, True Health, or the combo kit as a one-time purchase or subscription. Let me know what you think when you try it.
Sarah began serving her time in the Indiana Women's Prison. Later, she'd be at Rockville Correctional Facility. By many accounts, in the early years of her sentence, she was a model prisoner, intelligent, helpful to other inmates, and trying to better herself, but she was also determined to fight her conviction. She and her legal team immediately started the appeals process, working to overturn the verdict. They had some new ammo. Richard Hull had changed his story. While Sarah's appeals were winding through the courts unsuccessfully at first, Richard Hull agreed to help. In 2003, just a year after Sarah's trial, Richard provided a sworn affidavit admitting that he alone had killed Andrew and Tricia and that the incriminating letter was a forgery. This is huge. The co-defendant outright said Sarah did not do it. In the affidavit, Richard wrote that Sarah was set up by me so I could get a good plea, end quote. He explained that while he was in Marion County Jail awaiting his own fate, he got a fellow inmate named Steve Logan to forge the confession letter using samples of Sarah's real letters as a guide. Richard thought planting evidence to make Sarah look guiltier would help him negotiate a lighter sentence for himself, since it bolstered the narrative that she was the mastermind. Well, this revelation is as outrageous as it sounds. Richard Hull essentially admitted he fabricated key evidence that helped convict Sarah. The 2003 affidavit even details how he pulled it off. Logan, the cellmate, agreed to write this fake letter in exchange for Richard's protection in jail because Logan was a small guy who could use a big friend. Well, fingerprints later confirmed the letter had no prints from Sarah, but did have prints from Richard and Steve Logan. So, in other words, the physical evidence supported Richard's confession of the forgery. And honestly, it makes a little more sense to me to hear this part because Sarah, being pretty intelligent, you would think would be smarter than to write a jailhouse confession letter and send it in the jail, like while you're in jail. That would just be, I mean, level 10 stupid. But now, armed with this, Sarah's defense thought they had a slam dunk case for a new trial or appeal. And anyone would think so, right? If the only hard evidence tying her to planning the murders was this letter, and now the shooter is saying that he faked the letter, shouldn't that undo the conviction? But justice moves slowly and sometimes stubbornly. Sarah Pender's appeals, even with Richard's affidavit in hand, were denied again and again. Courts found technical reasons not to grant a new trial. For instance, they noted that Richard Hull was hardly credible and that he had already lied under oath. In fact, when Richard admitted the forgery, a judge used that against him. At Richard's resentencing hearing, the judge saw the affidavit where he confessed to perjury and added those 15 years to Richard's sentence, bumping him from 75 to 90 years. So Richard's attempt to help Sarah cost him extra prison time, but it didn't get Sarah out or help her at all. The court basically said, too bad, you were already convicted and we're not convinced that this new info changes everything, which is really frustrating and disappointing if you're on Sarah's team. But meanwhile, Sarah was growing desperate. By 2008, after about 6 years behind bars and multiple failed attempts at appeals, she started thinking a little outside the box, or rather outside the prison walls. If the legal system wouldn't free her, maybe she could free herself. So now enters another unbelievable chapter in this saga, which is her prison escape. Yes, Sarah broke out of prison, and not from some minimum security camp, from the Rockville Correctional Facility, a state prison in Indiana. So how did she pull this off? Well, with help and a lot of nerve. Remember how Sarah was described as manipulative and charismatic? Well, she put those skills to use on the inside. She befriended and, let's be real, seduced a correctional officer named Scott Spittler. Spittler was a guard at Rockville, and by 2008, he had entered into a completely inappropriate relationship with Sarah, reportedly sexual and conspiratorial. Sarah also roped in a former cellmate and friend on the outside, Jamie Long, who became an accomplice on the civilian side. In the months leading up to the escape, Sarah organized a little contraband smuggling ring with these allies. Guard Scott Spittler was sneaking in antihistamine pills like Sudafed, which can be sold or possibly used for meth production. And Sarah would then sell to fellow inmates for cash. She later admitted that she did this to raise money, initially for her legal appeals, and when those failed, to bankroll an escape plan. Spittler also smuggled in a cell phone for Sarah, which she used to coordinate with outside contacts. So if you're picturing Orange is the New Black, you're totally not far off. Finally, on the morning of August 4th, the plan went into action. Thanks to Officer Spittler, Sarah had civilian clothes to change into. He directed her to a particular door at the prison, one that he knew would be alarmed or unalarmed at the right time. Sarah slipped through that door and hid herself under a large storage bin in the back of a prison transport van. Conveniently, guess who was driving that van off the premises? Guard Spittler himself. He essentially chauffeured her right out of the prison under everyone's noses. Spittler drove out and parked at a nearby lot where Jamie Long, the friend and accomplice, was waiting in her vehicle. Sarah crawled out from her hiding spot and into Jamie's car, and away they went. By the time prison officials did a routine headcount and realized that one of their inmates was missing, Sarah Pender was long gone, free for the first time in 6 years, and now one of the most wanted fugitives in America. The manhunt for Sarah Pender was intense and highly publicized. her escape made national headlines. Remember that sensational female Charles Manson label? Well, it got trotted out in every news report. She was portrayed as cunning and dangerous, a sort of criminal mastermind who had managed to outfox the prison system. The story had obvious appeal. A young woman convicted of double murder escapes from a maximum security prison with the help of a love-struck guard. Like, you can't make this stuff up. And indeed, a movie would later be made about it. But Sarah didn't lie low exactly. She had to keep moving. So over the next several months, she hopped from place to place, relying on a network of people. Many of them were ex-cons that she either knew from prison or through friends to hide her. She changed her appearance, cutting and dyeing her hair. Desperate for funds, at one point she had a friend set her up on a date with a man as a sort of sugar daddy arrangement. Believe it or not, that man ended up recognizing her from TV. He realized, quote unquote, Ashley, the girl that he was hanging out with, looked exactly like the escaped Sarah Pender, whose face was all over the news. When he confronted her, Sarah didn't run. She actually convinced him that she'd been wrongly convicted and needed help. And incredibly, he bought it. She is just that manipulative. This unnamed Good Samaritan, if we can even call him that, helped Sarah relocate to Chicago, getting her a place to live and even an under-the-table job under the alias Ashley Thompson. So while Sarah was out on the lam, she achieved a certain outlaw celebrity. In fact, in November of 2008, America's Most Wanted featured her case on national TV. She was even placed on the U.S. Marshals 15 Most Wanted fugitives list, one of the few women to ever earn that dubious honor. The media was fascinated, dubbing her Indiana's Bonnie without Clyde, or the prison escapee who outsmarted the system. If social media had been as big then, she'd probably be trending all over it. But ultimately, her freedom didn't last. On December 22nd of 2008, nearly 5 months after she escaped, Sarah Pender's run came to an end. That night, America's Most Wanted re-aired her segment, and a neighbor in the North Side Chicago apartment building recognized the woman living next door as Sarah/Ashley. The tipster called it in. U.S. Marshals descended and captured Sarah Jo Pender without incident at the apartment where she'd been laying low. Just like that, she was back in custody. And there's actually a photo of her being led away in handcuffs on a snowy Chicago street, bringing the prison escape saga to a close. I'll put that picture on the cover art of this episode. Now, the fallout was severe for everyone involved. Sarah was punished with an extremely harsh penalty. Upon her return to Indiana, she was placed in solitary confinement for 5 years straight as punishment for the escape. 5 years isolated. No small thing that can break even the toughest people. I mean, you can't even imagine it, I'm sure. Prison guard Scott Spittler was, of course, arrested and prosecuted for aiding the escape, and he was sentenced to 7 years behind bars and served about three before paroling in 2011. His wife divorced him because, oh, by the way, he was married, unsurprisingly, after learning that he literally helped his secret inmate lover flee prison. Can you imagine being her? Oh, my husband cheated on me with an inmate at the prison where he works and helped her escape. Like, I think that would make me switch teams, actually. Jamie Long, the friend who drove the getaway car, was also caught and got a 7-year sentence, serving about 5 years, being released in 2013. The state of Indiana wanted to send a message that helping Sarah Pender was going to cost you. As for Sarah, those 5 years in solitary were rough, but also telling. During that time, she gave a few interviews, notably to famed British journalist Trevor MacDonald for a documentary. In that interview, Sarah, with a bit of a smirk, described how she pulled off the escape. She admitted the sexual relationship with Spittler, but claimed that he was mostly motivated by money, not just by her charms. She also maintained, as always, her innocence in the murders. But one curious anecdote was when Sarah said that prison officials told her mother that, quote, "Sarah is too smart for our prison," end quote, implying that that's why they kept her in solitary for so long. They feared that she'd scheme her way out again, even if she was given the chance. Was that true or just an excuse? It's hard to say, but Sarah's case certainly embarrassed the Indiana Department of Corrections big time. By 2014, Sarah was released from solitary and returned to the general prison population. She got busy rebuilding a life within prison. She earned multiple college degrees while incarcerated and became a tutor and a legal aid for other inmates, known to help others with their appeals. Fellow prisoners and staff described her as smart and resourceful. She even found love behind bars. In 2022, Sarah married another woman that she met in prison. Her wife was later released and sadly was reported to be battling terminal cancer on the outside, adding another layer of personal tragedy to Sarah's story. All the while, Sarah never stopped fighting for her freedom through legal channels, and gradually some outside help started to rally her cause. As years passed, doubts about the fairness of Sarah Pender's conviction only grew louder. And surprisingly, some of those doubts came from people who were once on the opposite side. So let's start with the evidence issues that emerged post-trial, because they really changed the narrative of this whole case. First of all, there's the forged letter that was debunked, of course. But then there was the snitch's credibility that was destroyed. Floyd Pennington, the jailhouse snitch. So after Sarah's trial, a trove of info came out about him too. In 2009, while helping journalist Steve Miller on a book about the case Girl Wanted, former prosecutor Larry Sells discovered a handwritten snitch list in the detective's files, a list authored by Floyd Pennington. On this two-page list, Pennington had written down the names of 17 different people, including Sarah, and offered to help police make drug buys, wear wires, do, quote, whatever I have to do, end quote, to get busts on all of these crimes. He was desperate to reduce his sentence. So Floyd was volunteering to set up or rat out a bunch of folks in exchange for leniency. And this document was never disclosed to Sarah's defense at trial, which is a serious omission, as it's evidence that could impeach a witness's credibility. Sells himself has said that he never saw it back then either, meaning the police or prosecutors just didn't flag it. But if the jury had known that Floyd Pennington was trying to sell out 17 people to save his own skin, they might have doubted his story about Sarah's confession. And there's more. Floyd's own post-release behavior was pretty telling. After serving a reduced term for his cooperation, he was released in 2008. And within a few months, he committed a violent rape and went back to prison. Not exactly a reliable, trustworthy guy. The lead detective on Sarah's case, Ken Martinez, also left Indiana under a cloud. He moved to Idaho and in 2008 had to resign from a police job due to an evidence mishandling scandal. So the two main pillars of the case, the letter and the snitch, look very shaky now in hindsight. So now let's talk about Larry Sells. He is the man who prosecuted Sarah and coined the female Charles Manson phrase. It's not often that you see a prosecutor do a public 180 on their own case, but that's exactly what happened. Over the years, as these issues came to light, and perhaps as he reflected, Larry Sells began to question the conviction. By 2023, Larry Sells, who's now retired, was openly advocating for Sarah Pender's release. He gave interviews and statements expressing his regret. In one interview, he said, quote, I have learned things since Sarah Pender's trial and conviction in 2002 that convinced me that important evidence presented at her trial was tainted and that her murder convictions should be set aside, end quote. He admitted that he built his whole case on what he now knows was a lie and a forged letter. And referring to the snitch Floyd, Sells acknowledged that had he known about that hidden snitch list, he would have never put Floyd Pennington on the stand. This is a big deal. Sells even said, quote, justice is long overdue for Sarah Pender. The legal system to date failed her, but that grievous error can and should be corrected, end quote. He stopped short of declaring her innocent, but he firmly believes that there's more than reasonable doubt about her guilt. The very man who once essentially called her a monster now calls her case a major injustice. It's almost unprecedented. As one law professor observed, he said, quote, I've never seen the former prosecutor, the person who put that person in prison, who advocated for the highest possible sentence, come out saying, I was wrong, this person should be granted relief. It is virtually unprecedented, end quote. And Larry Sells is not alone. other legal experts and advocates started rallying to Sarah's side. In 2021, Marion County established a conviction integrity unit to review possible wrongful convictions. Sarah's case was exactly the kind that they would look at, and she was hopeful about that, though bureaucratic wheels turn slowly. In 2023, Georgetown University law students in a program called Making an Exoneree picked up Sarah Pender's case to investigate and advocate. One of her co-counsels now is Professor Mark Howard of Georgetown, who has been vocal about her deserving a second chance. With the forged evidence and lying snitch exposed, many see Sarah as possibly wrongfully convicted, or at least over-convicted. Maybe she's guilty of being an accessory after the fact, but not of premeditated murder. Now, to be fair, public opinion on Sarah Pender is not unanimously sympathetic. There are still plenty of people who look at the undisputed facts that she bought the gun, she helped hide the crime, she later manipulated people and escaped prison, and they think that's exactly where she belongs. Even the writer of one detailed case study noted, quote, "Many key pieces of evidence have been debunked, but what are the odds that she just happened to go for a walk and Richard killed them in that short window?" And indeed, skeptics wonder if maybe Sarah orchestrated things but just managed to keep her hands physically clean. It's a case that provokes debate. Was she a victim of circumstance in a flawed justice system, or a master manipulator who's finally played all her cards? I want to know what you think about this story, if you think she was overconvicted, over-sentenced, and maybe deserves a second chance. But regardless of where one stands on her guilt, Sarah Pender has never stopped fighting for a way out of that 110-year sentence. After exhausting traditional appeals, her hope now lies in something called sentence modification, or possibly executive clemency. Recently, her efforts have gained serious traction, which is what brought her case to the weekly docket a couple weeks ago. So fast forward to December of 2025, right about now, as I'm recording this, Sarah Pender, who is now 46 years old, finally got a chance earlier this month to personally plead her case in front of a judge. On December 5th, a Marion County judge held a hearing to consider Sarah's petition to modify her 110-year sentence. Now, this is not a full retrial of guilt or innocence. It's basically asking the judge, you know, given all that's come to light and who I am today, can you cut me some slack on this sentence so that I don't die in prison? At that hearing, Sarah addressed the court, which is something that she did not do back in 2002. Reports say she spoke at length about her remorse and her growth over the last 25 years. She acknowledged that she deserved punishment for her role in what happened in 2000, specifically citing that she bought the gun, she didn't report the crime, and she did help Richard after the murders. She said, quote, "I deserved to go to jail. I bought the gun. I didn't run away and report the crime, and I helped Rick afterwards." You know, so she's not claiming to be a total angel, but she also conveyed how shocking it was to her to be held responsible as a murderer. She said, quote, "Shocked and devastated does not come close to how I felt when I was found guilty of Drew and Trish's murders," she told the judge. Now, Sarah pointed out that she has spent 25 years behind bars, which is a quarter of a century, and five of those years in solitary confinement, which is a heavy price. However, solitary confinement, in my opinion, I mean, you've got to be punished for escaping prison. You spent 5 months out of prison. I mean, you can't, like, I don't know. I don't know where you guys sit on that, but I'm kind of like, you kind of probably deserved that. But she says, quote, "After 25 years in prison and 5 years in solitary, I feel I've paid the price." She pleaded with the judge, saying that she was just asking for a chance to not die in prison. And for Sarah and her aging parents, who were in the courtroom hoping to see their daughter walk free before they themselves pass on, you can imagine that that was probably a pretty emotional moment. Her parents, Bonnie Prosser and Roland Pender, even spoke or submitted statements. They assured the court that if Sarah was released, that they would have a whole support plan ready. Bonnie described a loving home waiting in Arizona with a spare bedroom, a screened-in porch, some crazy cats, and two doting parents, a place where Sarah can peacefully rebuild her life. Also speaking on Sarah's behalf was the prosecutor-turned-ally Larry Sells, who reiterated that he believes Sarah played at most a limited role and that calling her the mastermind was wrong, and he flat-out called her sentence a major injustice to the judge. Her legal team emphasized other factors too, that Sarah was only 21 when this happened, basically a kid fresh out of her teen years, but still an adult in my opinion. Now she's in a midlife, like completely different person by all accounts. They argued that her age at the time should be seen as a mitigating factor. Science tells us that young adults don't have fully mature judgment. However, I completely understand why people say, you know, play stupid games, win stupid prizes. You do adult things, you get adult punishments, essentially. So I really, truly do see both sides. But they also pointed out that her exemplary behavior in prison, setting aside the escape, obviously, like her education, helping others, etc., that she's a completely different person now. However, not everyone is rooting for Sarah's release. Relatives of the victims strongly opposed any sentence reduction. They gave heartfelt statements about the permanent loss of Andrew and Trisha, the hole that it left in their lives, and their enduring belief that Sarah was culpable. Forgiveness was not on the table for them. Sarah addressed them directly in court, saying that she didn't expect forgiveness. She knows she won't get it, but that she wanted to express remorse. She said, quote, "I am so sorry for the terrible loss that you suffered and for the role I played in it." And she actually said that to the victims' families. It was an apology long in the making, though whether it made any impact on those families is hard to say. Their stance remained that Sarah should serve every last day of her sentence. When that hearing concluded, the judge did not give an immediate decision. He took the matter under advisement, which means he's thinking it over and will issue a ruling within a set time frame, reportedly within 30 days. So as of now, we're still waiting the judge's decision. I am recording this episode on December 29th, and as of today, there has been no update on his decision. If the judge grants the sentence modification, he could potentially cut her sentence down dramatically, even to time served of 25 years, which would make Sarah Pender a free woman almost immediately. He could also modify it to a lesser term that might see her released in a few years or eligible for parole if that mechanism exists still. But on the flip side, he could deny the request, leaving the 110-year sentence intact, meaning Sarah's only hope would then be executive clemency or some future legal Hail Mary. One interesting note is that typically sentence modifications in Indiana often require the consent of the prosecutor's office. The current Marion County prosecutor has to sign off or at least not object, and it's unclear if that happened. A 2013 attempt at a deal fell through because a prosecutor wouldn't sign off. But with a judge holding a hearing, it suggests that this is a special circumstance, possibly with new evidence claims. And given that a former prosecutor in the form of Larry Sells is on her side, there may be pressure on the current DA not to oppose. We do know the victims' families and likely the attorney general's representatives did oppose it at the hearing. So I will be watching for the judge's decision in probably this week, I would imagine, if not early next week, because I think that would be the 30-day timeline. And of course, I will update you probably on a weekly docket, which I do every Friday. I recap the top headlines in true crime for the week, so make sure you don't miss those. I've been loving the feedback that I get on those. You guys seem to really appreciate those. And if you ever have a case that you want me to take a look at, head to mamamystery.com and leave me a message in that white box at the bottom of the screen. If you want me to know who you are, though, please make sure you write who you are. And maybe if you want a response, give me a way to respond to you. Otherwise, it's totally anonymous. So until Friday's weekly docket, stay safe, stay curious, stay vigilant. Mama Mystery out.